Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world, welcome to SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup for December 12th, 2018. I'm Marty Bennett, president and founder of SMIE Consulting, and happy to be joined today to talk with you, to talk through three new issues in international education that popped onto our news feeds this past week. And I'd like to go through those with you today. For those of you not familiar with the Midweek Roundup, this is our take each Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, our take on three top issues of international education imports in our field, and how institutions and organizations around the world that are operating in the United States are looking to broaden their outreach are providing you some my take on how these issues can potentially be leveraged to your institution or organization's benefit. So really excited to be talking today about three topics that have been in the news quite a bit of late. And I'll share with you today what we're planning to talk about today. And first of all, for those of you who are in recruiting in India or familiar with post-study work opportunities, you're familiar with a lot of the news that or thoughts that the current administration has been proposing over the last couple of years that might tend to put a damper on prospective students studying here. And certainly we've seen the result of that in some countries like India, which suffered greatly in the last 2 years with particularly graduate student interest to the United States, with regard to their students who have decided to look at other destination countries because of complications in getting a visa or thoughts or perspectives that the post-study work opportunities were going to be curtailed in some regard. But now we're seeing for the first time, and this is, and we might be clutching at straws here, but for the first time in a while, seeing a positive potential policy change that would result in preference being given to international students that come to the United States and get advanced degrees, master's and doctoral level degrees, as it relates to H-1B visa applications. So there's been a couple of news stories that have covered this recently, in the past few days, and I'm posting the links to these on the Facebook page for SMIE Consulting, so you can feel free to reference those as we go along through this chat today. But what we're talking about here is, with this first topic, is that the federal government, under the Trump administration, is now proposing a new way of evaluating and awarding H-1B visas, and giving preference to those that have received advanced degrees, being master's or doctoral level degrees, in the United States. And for those who need some background on the H-1B awarding process, each year on April 1st, the government opens up the review process for applicants who want to receive H-1Bs. And these H-1Bs are basically sponsored by employers for internationals that they want to bring in to work for them, either from abroad directly to work for companies in the United States or from within the United States from U.S. institutions or people transferring from different visa categories. In this climate, and actually in the last decade or so, there's been some increases to the overall number of H-1B visas awarded, and then some reductions. But currently, for the last few years, there's been a cap of 65,000 visas per fiscal year, plus an additional 20,000 for applicants with an advanced degree from U.S. institutions. So those have been where most of those who have been educated in the U.S. Have gone, who have been able to receive H-1B visas have been able to get in, and it's sort of been kind of the back door rather than because it had a special carve out, they weren't really considered within the larger 65,000 cash that are available. And the challenge is each year the government gets far more visa applicants for these H-1B visas than they have space for. In 2017, 198,000, so three times the cap Caps, or well, the initial cap was 65,000. Three times that number were the number of visa applications received for H-1Bs. So what does that mean? For a lot of students who are attending U.S. colleges and universities, they have to first go through OPT. Rare is the case where you would have a student who finishes a degree and goes directly, has an employer who wants to sponsor him for H-1B right away, maybe in some of the real technical disciplines, scientific disciplines. There may be that kind of a situation that occurs. But the greater majority of international students who want to continue on to potentially H-1B visa status have to first go through OPT, or their optional practical training, which is a benefit of their F-1 status. So usually that'll be from 1 to 3 years per degree level, depending on what kind of academic program they studied in their degree studies. But the new regulation, what would happen is, right now the H-1B population is made up of over 70% Indian applicants, and that's a combination of companies that sponsor H-1B applications for people coming direct from India. Maybe these are folks that are working in tech field in India right now that might be brought over to work at American subsidiaries of those Indian companies, or direct recruits from India by U.S. businesses. So they right now, of that 65,000 each year, they get the Indian students are coming direct, or not Indian students, but Indian applicants are coming direct from India through companies that are brought in to work in the United States. So that's where the lion's share of H-1Bs go now. Combination of Indians coming direct from India to work for U.S. companies, and Indian students that are coming through OPT and then applying for H-1B. So that's where the greater majority, over 70% of all H-1B visas that were awarded this past year have gone to. Now, the new system, basically, what this will be doing by giving preference to H-1B applicants who have their advanced degrees from U.S. institutions is going to, in effect, encourage those that are doing their master's and doctoral programs here. They're going to get advantage over those applicants that might be coming direct from abroad. So this is encouraging for the international ed sector in that perhaps will be a greater carrot that will be attracting future students to our shores for degree studies. If there aren't changes to the STEM OBT program and other OPT changes that have been fluttered, then if they don't change those and then this becomes reality, this certainly makes the U.S. a much more attractive destination for those that want to come study first and then work, particularly for those looking at advanced degrees. Now, the one potential downside is that it will be harder for an H-1B applicant to be someone who is coming in just with an associate's or just a bachelor's degree from within the United States. And that may very well be true, but beggars can't be choosers, I don't think, in this political environment, and we should be taking some joy in what we're able to get with this particular change if it is in effect implemented. And what it'll mean, even though associate's and bachelor's degree candidates might not, after OPT, might not be able to be a good, maybe won't make a logical transition to an H-1B. For those students, it may encourage them to continue their studies here at the master's or doctoral level to improve their chances. If it truly is their goal to stay in the U.S. to work longer term, that H-1B pathway, the way that's being carved out with this new policy proposal, makes a lot of sense, if you ask me. So it's encouraging students to stay longer, to finish degrees, and then advanced degrees in particular, and then the pathway to H-1B is made a little bit clearer. How it will play out in the end, we don't really know until this gets implemented and we see some traction with regard to advanced degree holders in the United States applying for H-1Bs. And their companies that they're working for. That's just a little bit on what that first topic might mean as a positive change coming out of this administration. Who would have thought when it comes to international ed? Lou, thanks for joining us. Always good to have you joining the Midweek Roundup, and hope all is well with you. Moving on to the second topic today, it's related to China. China, and for those who have been in international education for more than a minute, you realize that the relationship between China and the United States is a very deep one when it comes to international education, for certain. But and overall, the relationship between the United States and China is a very complex one, one that has different relationships at the governmental level, on the economic level, educationally, certainly has an impact. And there have been some stories this week that point to three different looks at that relationship as they impact potential international education issues. Don't really want to spend too much time talking about the Huawei chief financial officer that was detained in Canada for potential extradition to the U.S. on charges of violating boycott on U.S. goods going to Iran through Huawei. So that case is still pending. Not a lot of miles to go there before that one gets decided, and how that will impact relationships long term. The trade wars that have been touted, and tariffs and all these other wonderful things. I don't want to really focus too much on that right now because a lot of that's still up in the air. But out of the G20 meetings in China, in Argentina, this last week or two ago, there was some signs and sounds from the Chinese side that the talks that Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping had were related to Chinese students studying in the United States and the impact of that, because as we know, there are well over 360,000 Chinese students currently in the United States at U.S. colleges and universities. The Xinhua news agency, the official news agency for the Chinese government, on Sunday hinted that there was a thaw, and that highlighted what it called progress toward reducing obstacles for Chinese students, and saying that the two countries agreed to increase communication in education. And this flies in the face of a lot of the press that has been circulating recently. I've just posted the article to that Bloomberg story that came out of the G20 summit, where after Trump and his counterpart Xi Jinping met in Argentina. And it does sound that maybe that is something that is a potential bright spot, or at least a resolution that on that ground, on the grounds of education, at least our two countries, China and the U.S., can be on the same page. It's really a fascinating relationship. As we know, there's a lot of public swagger and braggadocio that goes on, particularly from the U.S. side, and a lot of defensiveness coming from the Chinese side and fighting back a little bit, and tit for tat kind of issues going on. And that's all, I think, superficial. And certainly in terms of how it impacts international education, I think both sides see that relationship as a very important one in improving relationships between China and the U.S. And certainly Trump, interestingly, the Bloomberg article, the article's title is "China Hails Progress on U.S. Student Visas While Trump Stays Silent," and there's probably a lot of reasons why that happens on Trump's side. He certainly doesn't want to be one to be seeing overly welcoming of potential enemies, as he likes to call them, overseas. Lou, I know you've just asked about the Confucius Institute and how that's impacting that. I just saw another story. Probably talk more about that next week. I think there's a university. I don't know if it's the University of Michigan or an institution in Michigan. I haven't read the story yet. Has decided to sever ties with the Confucius Institute. There are a lot of sub issues to this relationship educationally. There was talk earlier in the year about Confucius Institutes being spies for the Chinese government in the United States, and the issues of STEM visas restrictions for Chinese scholars and students studying in the United States be reduced from 5 years to 1 year. So there's a lot of underlying issues that are kind of jabs here and there. The Confucius Institutes as a whole have been, I think, a lot of institutions that have become partners and had institutes opened on their campus have seen a lot of positives in terms of cultural explanations on Chinese culture and their involvement in activities and programming for institutions to hopefully improve relationships on that front. But there's always this kind of murky underbelly that exists when dealing with some of the relationships that those individual institutes have with their local with their host institutions and secrecy and what's allowed, what's not allowed, and other restrictions that are put in place. And it may be just another occurrence of institutions seeing Chinese. These opportunities to bring in Chinese students, or with the Confucius Institutes, bringing in the funding that they bring in, a way to just improve their bottom lines. That's a piece of the puzzle. I don't think it's the only thing, but certainly there's some issues there that are far from resolved, but certainly ones that would be will have some continued debate on this. Like I said, the multi-layered relationships between U.S. institutions and China. Another related piece on the recruitment side is a piece out of Arizona, public broadcasting station in Arizona, on just the relationship Arizona universities have with China and their increased attempts to enroll more Chinese students. Nothing for those that have been in international admissions a while. You certainly know that China obviously is the number one source of students, international students, in the United States, and many institutions, particularly large state institutions, have benefited greatly in times of declining state support for their budgets. A lot of these larger state institutions have turned to international student recruitment, and in particular Chinese student recruitment, to bolster their bottom lines. Arizona is certainly no exception to this, but I bring up the Arizona piece, and I've just posted the link to that article, is some of the digital efforts that these Arizona universities are taking to attract Chinese students, obviously using local Chinese social media with the Great Firewall blocking most Western social media, all the major ones that U.S. institutions use for in many other countries. These Arizona universities are turning to WeChat and Weibo and RenRen and Youku and those other Chinese social media specific channels. So I think that's important for, again, this is a public broadcasting station that's highlighting that piece of the puzzle for these institutions in Arizona. But it's also, they also in the article make reference to the economic impact in jobs and impact of international students on those local communities in Arizona. So I think that's always positive to see those kind of financial contributions as part of news stories like this. I think the international students brought in over $700 million to the Arizona economy in 2017. So there's those kind of stories are always good to see in the post Open Doors news that we see. But I bring that up just to highlight the recruitment piece an important part of the China discussion there with how you go about getting those students, and that's always an important. They're not just you're not just going to go picking them off trees anywhere. You actually have to work for them. But this is an important piece, I think, in just. Explaining more of what U.S. institutions are having to do to be effective in China. We look finally on this China issue, talk about a fantastic article in the Chronicle. And for those who aren't subscribers to the Chronicle, you may not be able to access this particular article, but it's one from Karen Fisher, their chief international correspondent, and touches on a very long article, but a very in-depth and well-detailed, well-sourced article on the impact Chinese students have and international students on a broader scale, but specifically international students have had on college towns in the United States. And that's actually the title of the article, From College Town to Chinatown. And there's obviously ups and downs to this, positives and negatives to the impact of such a large group of students from any one country coming to college towns in the United States. She focuses quite a bit on Michigan State University, and they've been in the press quite a bit for what they've been doing in China, less so for international ed stories, less so last year for other extracurricular activities there. One of their former doctors had, I was just hopefully going to be serving a long stint in prison and then hell shortly after. But in terms of what this article focuses on is the impact of how many Chinese students have come to East Lansing, Michigan, and they focus on the huge increase in the number of Chinese or Asian restaurants in the campus area. There with hot pots and hot pot restaurants and South China restaurants and even the regional differences within China that you have the, obviously a variety of food options and tastes that those from South China don't like spicy food, so from Guangzhou, so they're not big fans of the hot pot restaurants, so they stay away from that. So it's interesting to see the take that Karen has in this article, really well done, as I mentioned. But it's you're seeing the impact on East Lansing that diverse ethnic restaurants have flourished there with the increases in international students they've experienced there. Currently, Michigan State is number 18 in the United States with about 7,600 international students from this most recent Open Doors 2018. It's about 10,000 less than the number one institution, New York University, but certainly a big player in the market, and certainly a large share of their international student growth over the last decade has come from Chinese students in particular. They have, in the last year, experienced a bit of a drop. International enrollments were down 18% this year from their 2014 high. So there's been not so good news in the last two or three years, but they've seen Chinese students, as I mentioned, have really driven a lot of their growth, and are now they're feeling the effects of some of that drop in growth is coming from China. So really a well done article, just sharing more broadly what these students are able to take advantage for, and this is a great example of supply meeting demand in terms of the availability of Asian groceries, of restaurants, and other even Asian karaoke bars, or Chinese karaoke bars near the Michigan State campus. So there's a lot of great details in here about the impacts on college towns, particularly for state universities that you see, and it's good to see what happens there. Karen also points specifically to the economic impact of for the towns that these major college towns at Michigan State and East Lansing, the range of institutions in Boston, where the economic impact just in Boston alone from the universities, the international students at those universities, is $1.6 billion of economic benefit to the Boston metropolitan area from those international students. At Urbana-Champaign in Illinois, where U of I is, almost $500 million just in that area. Of $500 million in from the University of California, Berkeley, from their international students. A third of a billion from Arizona State in Tempe, and over a third of a billion from Purdue in West Lafayette, Indiana. So just some huge economic benefits to these communities. So kudos to Karen Fisher for her for that article on a very in-depth approach to looking at the impact of international students on college towns, and in particular Chinese students. So very, very curious. And I'm sure there'll be more to come on that. Now, last article, there's been a lot of positive news north of the border in recent months about how their international student populations are booming. We covered a bit of that last week in the midweek roundup, talking about how some institutions, particularly smaller institutions in Ontario, have 30 to 50% or more international of their students being international. just incredible growth and how their the institutions are struggling to keep up with the services and the demands. So of those students on their institutions. So it's interesting to see what another story, because it's kind of a kind of victims of their own success that they're now struggling with some of the after effects of how do we deal with all these students. But one of the real drawing points for international students, we've seen this in countless surveys surveys that have assessed for student perspectives on studying abroad outside their home countries. IDP student buyer behavior report that came out a month or so ago looked at the six top English language destination countries and asked students their perceptions on who were best in post-study work, in visas, in affordability, quality, safety, those type of issues. And Canada ranked very highly in visa, ease of getting a visa, safety, and post-study work. Post-study work in Canada is being made increasingly easier for Canadian students, and in fact is one of the big draws. In some of the provinces that are less populous ones, particularly in the east and northwest, and even some of the central provinces that don't have huge metropolitan areas, they are putting in place, particularly on the east coast of Canada, putting in place incentives for the international students that come and study there to have an easier path, even easier than international students in the country as a whole would have, to become citizens after they're finished with their degrees. The article that I've just posted is from the Eye Opener in Canada, that takes a look at some of the barriers that international students have to settling and employment in Canada. And that's there have international. It talks about the increase in international student populations in Canada and how the impact of at Ryerson has had in Canada. They have 43,000 undergrad and grad students at Ryerson, and in fall 2017, about 1,800 of those students were international, The article goes through some of the struggles those students have had related to work permits and in terms of citizenship and permanent residency issues that they have. Talks about the lack of resources that international students have about immigration policies and those types of things. So it's really, I think, exposing not the huge problems that they're having there, but I think compared to what international students are facing in the United States, they've got a lot easier right now in Canada. But in terms of regulations and restrictions and pathways to citizenship after studies, so it's the first time I'm seeing at a major school like Ryerson, you start seeing some of these issues about how well prepared and taken care of these students are for life at the university and then afterwards. So that's interesting to see that, but I'm sure won't be the last one we hear, because as we talked about last week, the capacity issues that many of these Canadian institutions are now beginning to run up against is that they may no longer they're either going to have to stretch and expand their services dramatically to care for these international students. For example, the Ryerson story just mentioned that they have only two international student advisors for the 2,000 international students that they have. So at the U.S., it's considered you're well overburdened, and there's a lot of debate on what's an appropriate ratio of advisees to advisors for international students in the U.S. But when you've got a 4-to-1 or 1-to-1,000 ratio, that's pretty bad in terms of actual advisors helping with immigration issues and employment issues and those type of things for the students while they're on campus. So it's a bit of a concern, and those services concerns are ones that are being felt now at particularly our Canadian institutions that weren't used to having large numbers of international students, that have been kind of absorbing them quite a bit over the last couple of years. And Jim, good to see you. I hope you recovered from AIRC last week. Thanks again for breakfast on Saturday. Hope you're well. And with regards to Canada, those numbers are continuing to grow, but expect there to be some pushback in the next year or two, just in terms of capacity. That there are, look, face it, look, there's only 100 institutions of post-secondary institutions in Canada, many of which are 15, 20, 25% or more international already, and they're beginning to struggle with these with the huge volume that they have had. So with regards to international student growth over the last couple of years, and now the services side is beginning to suffer, and the issues that that brings to the fore in terms of services for international students are really becoming more apparent. So good to keep an eye on that story as it develops in Canada. We'll be sure to do that here on the Midweek Roundup. For those who have been subscribing to the podcast, it is now available. If you don't want to see me do this show every week, you can listen to it on your favorite podcast provider, iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, Stitcher, whatever you choose. Google Play, obviously, it's available there as well. Also on YouTube. And for those, if you want the full story and all the background and links to the articles I'm referencing here on the Facebook page. So thank you again for joining us this week. I really look forward to exploring more of these issues with you, and I'll put up our website here and our podcast links. Those are available, as I mentioned, on all major platforms. The website also has links to my blogs and articles that I've presented on, as well as services that SMIE Consulting offers more broadly to the international community. So I encourage any who would like more information to get in touch with us at smieconsulting.org. I'm looking forward to speaking with you in future. Thanks again for joining us, and have a wonderful week. Cheers.